taxes were being eliminated, the economy was humming along nicely, half a continent was peacefully acquired, simply crowded out the bad news. At the height of the Sally stories, John Quincy Adams suggested that the Federalists were forced to resort to such scandal-mongering because their political program had been completely and irrevocably abandoned and rejected by the popular voice. Whatever alarm Jefferson's supporters felt, he observed, would prove short-lived. "What they take for breakers," Adams noted, "are more clouds of unsubstantiated vapor." This became Jefferson's public position as well. The frantic behavior of the Federalist press was symptomatic of its utter desperation, he insisted, as its cause slid beneath the surface of American politics forever. The Federalists were simply clutching at dirt as they went under. But the experience took its toll on Jefferson's view of the American press. His eloquent statement in the inaugural address, "Let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it," implied that complete freedom of the press was both inviolable and self-correcting. Now he was not so sure. "Our newspapers, for the most part, present only the caricatures of disaffected minds," he concluded in 1803, and what he called "the abuses of the freedom of the press" had generated a scatological political culture never before known or borne by any civilized nation. Jefferson actually had a point, since his presidency coincided with an exponential increase in the sheer number of American newspapers, as well as the abiding sense, left over from the 1790s, that there were no official or unofficial rules of conduct governing what would or should be printed. Jefferson wanted the press to be free, but he had also presumed that a free press would maintain some measure of respect for the truth. The free-for-all mentality and ricochet style of the multiplying newspapers allowed him to persuade himself that the very principle of freedom of the press was being destroyed by its own excesses. "This is a dangerous state of things," he explained to Thomas McKean of Pennsylvania, "and the press ought to be restored to its credibility if possible." He did not have anything so heavy-handed as the Sedition Act in mind. Instead, he suggested that Republican governors in selected states target the most offensive Federalist editors for libel. "And I have therefore long thought," he apprised McKean, "that a few prosecutions of the most prominent offenders would have a wholesome effect in restoring the integrity of the presses, not a general prosecution, for that would look like persecution, i.e., the Federalist approach with the Sedition Act, but a selected one." Governors McKeon in Pennsylvania and DeWitt Clinton in New York took the suggestion as a command to release their lawyers on the most recalcitrant Federalist editors. As Jefferson saw it, he was not violating a principle so much as rescuing it from its own abusive and self-destructive tendencies. But it was clearly at least a half-step backward from his earlier incantations to unbridled freedom of speech. Gibraltar. The same line in his mind that separated salvageable Federalists from incurables, good Indians from bad, also separated responsible journalists from loathsome liars. Until that line was crossed, he could be the essence of tolerant amiability. On the other side of the line, however, there could be no mercy, since the moral issues at stake were not susceptible to negotiation or compromise. Within this powerful moralistic scheme, one group was permanently planted on the far side of the Jeffersonian divide, and in fact served as the most visible symbol of the institutionalized evil that still managed to defy the pure republicanism Jefferson wished to restore. These were the judges of the federal courts, especially the so-called midnight judges Adams had appointed during his lame duck phase. Soon after Jefferson named Levi Lincoln as his attorney general, he told him that the removal of the excrescences from the judiciary is the universal demand. William Branch Giles, his Virginian protege, who was elected to the Senate in the Republican avalanche of 1800, reminded Jefferson that the revolution is incomplete so long as that strong fortress is in possession of the enemy. Since the Jeffersonian mentality actually required discernible enemies in order to unlock its dynamic energies, one could argue that Adams had done him a backhanded favor by his judicial legacy. But if the federal judiciary was a convenient target that mobilized all the Jeffersonian firepower, it was also, as the editor of the National Intelligencer put it, the Gibraltar of federalism, sitting squarely and impregnably in the midst of Republican waters. Jefferson spent much of his first term circling this Federalist fortress, sending his most devoted soldiers like Giles against it, but never breaching its formidable defenses. It is important to distinguish between Jefferson's animosity toward the Midnight Judges as political appointments and his more general hostility toward the federal judiciary as an institution. In 1804, as part of an unsuccessful effort to resume friendly relations with John and Abigail Adams, he explained to her that the one act of Mr. Adams's life that had genuinely upset him and struck him as personally unkind was the appointment of Federalists to the federal court. "They were among my most ardent political enemies," he complained, "and from whom no faithful cooperation could ever be expected. It seemed but common justice to leave a successor free to act by instruments of his own choice." The most offensive appointment, of course, was John Marshall's selection as Chief Justice, which was especially loathsome for several reasons. First, because it was a lifetime appointment. Second, because it placed a Federalist atop the entire national judiciary system. And third, because Marshall himself was, in his own different way, more formidable an adversary than Hamilton. Marshall was the rarest of creatures, a Federalist with a Jeffersonian style. He was the one man whom Jefferson did not believe he could outduel in behind-the-scenes political fighting. "When conversing with Marshall," he confessed, "I never admit anything. So sure as you admit any position to be good, no matter how remote from the conclusion he seeks to establish, you are gone. So great is his sophistry, you must never give him an affirmative answer, or you will be forced to grant his conclusion. Why, if he were to ask me if it were daylight or not, I'd reply, 'Sir, I don't know, I can't tell.'" Beyond the personal hatred and the understandable bitterness at being saddled with the Adams appointments lay Jefferson's more tortured sense of hostility toward the entire federal judicial system per se. Part of the problem with recovering his mentality in this area is that it does not fit neatly into the logical and legal categories that constitutional scholars, who have done the best work on the general subject, have tended to bring with them. Questions about federal versus state jurisdiction, for example, or the highly controversial question about judicial review, did not engage his full attention, except as specific episodes in a larger political drama about the true meaning of the American Revolution. And the simple truth was that the original American revolutionaries had not envisioned a national judiciary at all. At times, Jefferson seemed to believe that to be true to the original spirit of 76, all federal courts should be abolished completely and the judicial decisions left to the states. But such thoughts did not emerge out of specific legal arguments so much as a grander sense of sweeping away the institutional residue that had built up since the Revolution. Similarly, Jefferson did not have a consistent or cogently constructed position on the ultimate questions of constitutional sovereignty. In his more radical moments, he seemed to believe that all fundamental constitutional questions should be settled by a popular referendum, since the doctrine of popular sovereignty empowered only the people at large to render such judgments. This was obviously burdensome, if not completely impractical, but it drew inspiration from the same visionary impulse that welcomed a sweeping away of all laws every generation. In his first annual message to Congress, he proposed a more moderate idea that each branch of the federal government was sovereign and therefore empowered to interpret the Constitution for itself. Gallatin and Madison, recognizing the confusion inherent in such a position, persuaded him to delete the paragraph. To be fair, Jefferson was hardly alone in grappling unsuccessfully with the proper role of the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court. the judicial institutions were still congealing as integral parts of the national government, nor had there been any clear consensus at the Constitutional Convention about the role of the Supreme Court as the ultimate arbiter of the Constitution's meaning. Hamilton had made the clearest case on behalf of the principle of judicial review in Federalist 78, but it was part of the genius of the constitutional settlement of 1788 to leave such controversial questions blurry and unresolved. In that sense, Jefferson's confusion accurately mirrored the crisscrossing currents of constitutional opinion prevalent at the time. But Jefferson's mind preferred to operate at a higher altitude, where the details and technicalities disappeared from sight and the larger moral patterns assumed a clear shape. From that perspective, he saw the federal judiciary and its capstone in the Supreme Court as a source of unmitigated danger. If the West, for Jefferson, was the dynamic engine of expansion and national liberation that continually vitalized the American Republic with its energy, the federal judiciary was the engine of centralization and consolidation that sucked the energies of the new nation into a stifling sinkhole. The fact that all the crucial offices were filled with Federalists was obviously bad enough, but the federal judiciary itself embodied counter-revolutionary tendencies fundamentally at odds with the deepest impulses of pure republicanism as Jefferson understood it. Jefferson's views were distinctive and radical on this score. Both Adams and Madison recognized the need for a judicial counterpoise to majority rule. The fact that federal judges served for life and were least accountable to popular opinion was, as they saw it, an important asset, for such requirements helped balance the democratic excesses of the more directly elected branches of government. Jefferson, however, saw no need for such balancing mechanisms. For him, the American Revolution was about release, not restraint. In addition to being a Federalist Gibraltar, occupied by his most devoted enemies then, the national judiciary was a permanent brake placed on the wheels of the ongoing American Revolution. The battle over the judiciary took the form of three distinct skirmishes. The first, in the winter of 1802, occurred in the Congress, where the Republicans used their majority to repeal the Judiciary Act of 1801. Jefferson had launched the attack in his first annual message. The judiciary system, and especially that portion of it recently erected, he declared, will of course present itself to the contemplation of Congress. He was referring specifically to the Judiciary Act of 1801, which was offensive to Republicans for several reasons. It was a partisan measure passed by the lame duck Congress in February, when the Federalists were scrambling to shore up their control over the court system before Jefferson took office. It established a separate circuit court with 16 new judges, essentially creating a new layer of federal jurisdiction between the Supreme Court and the district courts. And most of the midnight judges appointed by Adams filled these new circuit court posts. Although Jefferson was active in mobilizing the Republican forces behind the scenes, he made a point of maintaining a distance from the congressional debates, which were heated, and attempted to present his opposition to the circuit courts in the most innocuous terms, claiming that there were simply not enough cases to justify the new layer of federal judges. Rather than raise the controversial constitutional or ideological issues about the entire judicial system, he preferred to cast the issues in terms of Republican austerity. Given the Republican dominance in the Congress, victory was a foregone conclusion. Gallatin had already prepared the budget estimates for 1802 on the presumption that the circuit court judges would be eliminated. The second skirmish occurred in 1803 in the unfriendly arena of the Supreme Court, where Marshall's influence and intellectual agility worked its customary magic to produce an embarrassing defeat for Jefferson. The matter at issue was unquestionably trivial, the appointment of William Marbury to a low-level post as Justice of the Peace in the District of Columbia. The subsequent historical significance of Marshall's decision was just as unquestionably massive. It became the landmark precedent for the principle of judicial review and for the Supreme Court's sovereign right to interpret the meaning of the Constitution. But in the historical context of the time, Marshall's celebrated opinion in Marbury v. Madison occupied an inherently middle ground, neither trivial nor dramatically principled. It provided the occasion for Marshall to lecture Jefferson for failing to uphold the law by refusing to appoint Marbury. The message was clear to all the interested parties of the day. The Republican assault on the federal judiciary may have been successful at eliminating the circuit courts, but the Supreme Court was off limits. The Federalist fortress on Gibraltar could fire back. The legal genius of Marshall's opinion, what Jefferson described as sophistry and later as Marshall's twistifications, derived from the Chief Justice's rearrangement of the questions presented to the court, which allowed him to rule against Marbury's petition only after lecturing the president and ruling on the constitutionality of an act of Congress, the Judiciary Act of 1789. If he had taken up the questions in the order in which they were presented, there would have been no need to address the broader issues. The political genius of Marshall's opinion was double-barreled. He enhanced the power of the Supreme Court by denying its jurisdiction, and he patronized the president while deciding the case in his favor. It was vintage Marshall at his most maddeningly covert. It also revealed that Marshall, much like Jefferson, preferred to avoid a direct confrontation on the abiding role of the federal judiciary, since he had masked his assertion of judicial review under the veil of impotence and had ruled that Jefferson, though in violation of the law, did not need to appoint Marbury after all. Having sallied forth from his fortress, Marshall had returned quietly to the safety of Gibraltar. The third skirmish came at the end of Jefferson's first term, when the Republicans in Congress, at the president's instigation, unsuccessfully attempted to impeach Justice Samuel Chase. Next to Marshall, Chase was the most formidable Federalist presence on the Supreme Court, a white-maned giant who preferred to play the role of Jehovah with all Jeffersonians who had the misfortune to land in his courtroom. He had attracted sharp criticism for his strenuous support of the Sedition Act, most especially, and ironically for Jefferson himself, because of his intemperate conduct in dispatching James Callender to a Richmond jail during Callender's anti-Federalist phase. If Marshall was the master of stealth and guerrilla tactics, Chase preferred to lead cavalry assaults. In May 1803, after reading about Chase's inflammatory charge to a Baltimore jury, Jefferson wrote to a Republican leader in the House, "Might this seditious and official attack on the principles of our Constitution go unpunished? And to whom so pointedly as yourself will the public look for the necessary measures? I ask these questions for your consideration. For myself, it is better that I should not interfere." This was the equivalent of a command to his Republican lieutenants in Congress to launch impeachment proceedings against Chase. But impeachment, as Jefferson readily acknowledged, was a clumsy instrument, requiring as it did evidence of treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. Though the Republicans attempted to wrap themselves in the trappings of legality, the trial in the Senate had a distinctly partisan flavor that struck several observers as a Republican version of the Sedition Act. Jefferson followed the proceedings closely. He kept a running tabulation of the votes on each count for conviction, but maintained official silence. Chase was eventually acquitted on all the charges. His Federalist defenders enjoyed the advantage of the narrow requirements imposed by the Constitution for removing judges. They could plausibly describe Chase as a political target and victim, and they particularly relished the opportunity to remind Jefferson that the principle of an independent judiciary had been a rallying cry in 1776, as well as one of the sacred truths that Jefferson had once accused George III of violating. Over the subsequent course of American history, several presidents also attempted to take on the Supreme Court, and all came away with a similar sense of frustration as Jefferson. But these latter-day challenges to the judicial branch all occurred after the Supreme Court had achieved quasi-sacred status as the one American political institution that was presumed to receive its instructions directly from God rather than from the electorate. Jefferson's campaign against the judiciary predated the public enshrinement of federal courts, most especially the Supreme Court, as the designated Olympian element in the government. Indeed, Jefferson's campaign was driven by the conviction that, as he put it, independence of the will of the nation is a solecism, at least in a republican government. What appears almost sacrilegious to us was then still in the process of carving out its place in American political theology. For Jefferson, the religious wellspring that inspired his vision of the sacred remained the pure republicanism of the American Revolution. The federal judiciary had no prominent place in that vision, indeed no place at all, and Jefferson went to his grave believing that Marshall and his colleagues on the Supreme Court were an evil conclave, a gang of sappers and miners, sabotaging the republican experiment from within. But if his ideological convictions were clear and unwavering, his reluctance to declare unlimited war on the federal judiciary stands out as the defining feature of the conflict. Perhaps at some level he recognized that a national government required some kind of national system of laws, that those moderate Republicans who regarded the Constitution and the Constitutional Settlement of 1787-88 as the sacred corollary to the revolutionary magic of 1776 had at least half a point. If so, he never acknowledged this concession publicly or privately. It might have been one of those silent occasions when Madison's invisible influence proved decisive. Or perhaps Hamilton was right after all, that Jefferson's aversion to conflict dictated a policy of caution for purely personal reasons, in spite of his moral certainty that the federal judiciary was a blot on the face of pure republicanism. Or perhaps his own belief in the inherent limitations that republicanism imposed on the executive branch, the unimperial presidency, made more decisive action impossible for him. One cannot be sure of the right answer here, or even be sure that Jefferson himself knew what it was, if it existed at all. For it was in this context, after all, that Henry Adams composed his most arresting portrait of Jefferson's elusive character. Almost every other American statesman might be described in a parenthesis, Adams observed. A few broad strokes of the brush would paint the portraits of all the early presidents with this exception, but Jefferson could be painted only touch by touch with a fine pencil, and the perfection of the likeness depended upon the shifting and uncertain flicker of its semi-transcendent shadows. Lists and Losers. At some point during the year before his elevation to the presidency, Jefferson wrote an uncharacteristically personal note to himself under the title Memorandum of Services. I have sometimes asked myself whether my country is the better for my having lived at all, he mused to himself. I have been the instrument of doing the following things, but they would have been done by others, some of them perhaps a little better. He then went on to list a curious version of his public accomplishments, placing the dredging of the Rivanna River alongside the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, importing olive plants from France, beside the efforts to end the slave trade. An updated version of the list, composed at the end of his first term as president, would surely have added appreciably to his achievements. The two presidential accomplishments that gave him the most satisfaction were the Louisiana Purchase and the retirement of a substantial portion of the national debt. Although pockets of federalism held out in parts of New England, as a viable national party, the Federalists were finished. Except for the ongoing naval action against the Barbary pirates, a limited affair, America was at peace with the world. And that symbol of government's unwelcome reach into private lives, the tax collector, had been banished, along with the circuit court judges, much of the army and navy, a boatload of civil servants and several tribes of recalcitrant Indians. He had no way of knowing it, of course, but Jefferson's first term was to go down as one of the two or three most uniformly successful in American presidential history in achieving its stated objectives. In more personal terms, the Federalist attacks on his character had taken an emotional toll. But he claimed that it was precisely the unfounded calumnies of the Federal Party that persuaded him to run for a second term. He had always presumed, he explained to Eldridge Gerry, that he would retire after 4 years, but the lingering presence of Federalist propaganda in the press, though like letters from the dead, needed to be silenced completely. "They force my continuance," he claimed. "If I can keep the vessel of state as steadily on her course another 4 years, my earthly purposes will be accomplished, and I shall be free to enjoy," then the familiar refrain, "my family, my farm, and my books." His re-election, if he chose to run, was a foregone conclusion. But something had gone out of him, even as he decided to prolong his presidency. The burdens of the office undoubtedly accumulated with time. The Federalist assaults on his personal honor also inflicted wounds that never completely healed. His physical constitution, though still remarkably robust for a 61-year-old man, was now bedeviled by recurrent bouts of diarrhea that periodically sapped him of energy. The most devastating blow, however, came in April 1804, when Maria died from complications in childbirth, much as her mother had done. "Others may lose of their abundance," he wrote to John Page, his lifelong soulmate, "but I, of my want, have lost even the half of all I had." His prospects, he believed, now hang on the slender thread of a single life. This was Martha, the only one left to populate the family circle from the original Jefferson dream, which he now described as fearfully blighted. He was never really the same after Maria's death, less exuberant and more fatalistic, and history was already preparing a series of unpleasant surprises on the international scene that were destined to make his second term as president a headlong fall from grace. Chapter 5. Monticello, 1816-26. "I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past." Jefferson to John Adams, August 1, 1816. "I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I live not to weep over it." Jefferson to John Holmes, April 22, 1820. Visitors during his last decade could catch a glimpse of the ex-president astride his favorite horse in the early afternoon of most days, when he rode Eagle for 2 or 3 hours through the fields and woods around Monticello. Time had taken its inevitable toll on his aging body in all the little ways that accumulate in the joints and arteries of formerly athletic young men past their prime. But the nagging disabilities that made rising from a chair or walking through his garden more difficult somehow disappeared once he was on horseback. In 1809, when he was 65, he had taken his final ride home from Washington to permanent retirement without assistance, and had pressed on for the final 8 hours through a driving snowstorm. As Eagle aged along with him and became Old Eagle, the members of the family worried that these solitary rides each afternoon placed both man and mount at some risk. But Jefferson brushed aside such cautionary concerns, explaining that, while an old man on his own legs, he was still a young man in the saddle. Even after he broke his arm in a fall off the back steps of Monticello in 1822, he insisted on his daily ride. He had Old Eagle brought up to the terrace so that he could be mounted from the height of the porch, eased himself into the saddle with his good arm while the horse leaned patiently against the terrace wall, then assumed the bolt-straight posture of a born rider and trotted off like a natural aristocrat, keeping his appointment with destiny. We know more about his physical appearance and daily regimen during his last decade than at any other period of his life. He was, after all, a prominent member of America's founding generation, obviously destined to take his place in the history books, so visitors felt a special urge to record their impressions of the Sage of Monticello for posterity. The inexorable ravages of the aging process also forced Jefferson himself to chronicle the physical and medical realities as they encroached upon his earlier indifference to such matters. He remained to the end congenitally suspicious of all doctors, claiming that whenever he saw three physicians together, he looked up to see if there was not a turkey buzzard in the neighborhood. But he also recognized, as he reported to Adams, that Our machines have been now running for 70 or 80 years, and we must expect that worn as they are, here a pivot, there a wheel, now a pinion, next a spring, will be giving way. The old argument over the color of his hair, was it red or blonde, was now displaced by the common description of family and friends that it was completely gray. He also cut it shorter, eliminating the tied queue in the back, in part because it was easier to care for, in part because the longer style was beginning to seem old-fashioned. When walking outside or riding, he tended to wear a large, round, broad-brimmed hat to shield his face from the sun. Despite this protection, his facial skin was blotchy and usually peeling from exposure. The capillaries just beneath the surface were easily ruptured, giving his face irregular coloration. Biologically as well as psychologically, he was thin-skinned. Recurrent diarrhea and intestinal disorders sapped his energy. This was the ailment that eventually killed him. So he needed a cane much of the time he was on his feet, and his loyal black servant, Burwell, the successor to Jupiter and James Hemings, accompanied him at all times except during his afternoon ride. His posture remained remarkably erect despite the cane, though several visitors noted that his head and neck now inclined forward, as if he were always leaning into the wind. When guests joined him for a tour of the grounds, they tended to be surprised at his passionate and animated way of talking and the rapidity of his speech, which tended to come in bursts of varying length and was accompanied by an emphatic shrugging of his shoulders and gesturing with his long arms and large hands. An itinerant bookseller, clearly expecting a more sedate and stoic demeanor, described him as less a philosopher than a partisan. Jefferson's preferred mode of dress also caught some visitors off guard because of its informality. He tended to wear a brightly colored, usually red, vest, underneath a gray waistcoat and loosely fitting pantaloons or corduroy pants that were usually tucked into his riding boots. He dressed, in other words, less like a former statesman or aspiring national icon than a working Virginia planter. Despite the cane and the blotchy skin and the disjunction between his nonchalant demeanor and the godlike expectations, almost all observers commented on his relatively youthful appearance. At 80, he looked 60. His diet and daily regimen continued to follow the old patterns. He ate very little red meat, preferring vegetables, poultry, and shellfish, though regular fish did not agree with his digestive system. He drank coffee and tea at breakfast, malt liquor and cider at dinner. While he avoided all hard liquors, he enjoyed 3 or 4 glasses of wine each day. He rose with the sun regardless of the season, usually getting 5 to 8 hours of sleep, the length contingent upon the retirement hour, which itself depended on the quality of conversation when there were guests in the house or his interest in the book he was reading that evening. He bathed his feet in cold water every morning, devoted the early part of each day to his correspondence and his garden, rode each afternoon, then made himself sociable with family and guests at dinner until dark. His hearing remained good except, as he put it, when several voices cut across each other, which meant that he could not always follow conversations over dinner. His eyesight was excellent at a distance, but he relied on glasses for reading, especially at night. Certain poignant scenes, like verbal tableau, have been passed down in the reminiscences of his grandchildren. Like the description of his daily excursion aboard Old Eagle, they conjure up some of the most attractive and nearly idyllic moments, when his retirement years managed to capture the pastoral and domestic serenity he had been pursuing throughout his life. There is the scene in his garden, just after breakfast, working beside Wormley, his gardener, who is tending the spade and hoe, while Jefferson aligns the rows of flowers and vegetables with a measuring line, or clips off excess buds and leaves with his pruning knife. Or there is the scene on the terrace after dinner, as Jefferson organizes foot races for his grandchildren around the house, dropping a white handkerchief for the start, then seeing to it that the younger and slower children receive pieces of fruit just like the winners. There were 2 minor but naggingly persistent intrusions into the domestic serenities on the mountaintop. and both were direct consequences of Jefferson's stature as one of the last survivors of 1776. First, the steady flow of guests, tourists, and self-proclaimed Jeffersonians made Monticello into a virtual hotel for at least 8 months of the year. "I need not tell you what open doors he lives," one visitor reported in 1815. "As you well know, his mountain is made a sort of Mecca." Members of Congress, foreign dignitaries, Indian agents, retired army and naval officers, Protestant missionaries, itinerant booksellers, aspiring Virginia politicians, all felt the obligation to make the pilgrimage to Monticello. Once there, a distressingly large number chose to regard Jefferson's generic offer of hospitality as a personal invitation to stay for several days. Martha's daughter, Ellen, recalled that her mother sometimes had to feed and entertain 50 overnight guests. Total strangers who were simply passing through seemed to believe that Monticello was a national shrine where they could declare sanctuary. They often peered through the windows when the family was seated at dinner, walked right into the front hallway, chipped off pieces of brick or wood as souvenirs, even joined the invited guests over tea or wine, and struck up conversations with the patriarch himself, who was sometimes not sure whether he was addressing a guest or an interloper. By 1816, as this persistent stream of visitors became a virtual flood, Jefferson retreated 3 or 4 times a year to his estate in Bedford County, about 90 miles from Monticello. He supervised the finishing touches on what became his poplar forest home away from home, a smaller but even more architecturally distinctive dwelling than Monticello. Poplar Forest was shaped as a perfect octagon, and used it as his personal refuge whenever Monticello became overoccupied. Second, his correspondence became a massive and time-consuming burden. Jefferson received more than 1,000 letters each year of his retirement. In 1820, he made a point of keeping an accurate record and counted 1,265 separate letters, most from people he did not know, many requesting long answers to historical questions. He spent 3 or 4 hours each morning trying to respond, then often returned to the writing desk before retiring at night. "Is this life?" he asked Adams, answering his own question by describing himself as a mill horse who sees no end to his circle but in death. Adams commiserated with what Jefferson had called his epistolary corvée, noting mischievously that he did not have Jefferson's problem, because he had been prescient enough to make himself unpopular. Moreover, as Adams explained, he simply neglected to answer the letters from cranks and well-intentioned strangers so that he could devote his remaining energies to correspondents who counted, the chief one being Jefferson himself. But Adams's sense of humor was lost on Jefferson, who somehow felt a relentless obligation to respond personally to everyone. Madison advised him to prepare a formulaic letter, a standard response that the family can send out expressing thanks, but he could not comply. Especially after arthritis in his wrist and fingers worsened with age, he complained that the unceasing drudgery of writing keeps me in unceasing pain and peevishness. Only a few months before his death, he lamented that his rescue from the writing table rested on the hitherto elusive hope that the discretion of those who have no claims upon me will at length advert to the circumstances of my age and ill health, and feel the duty of sparing both. But it was not meant to be. Neither the presumptuous pilgrims to Monticello, nor the countless correspondents throughout the country could be made to respect his privacy and leave him alone. As a living legend, he had become public property. He claimed that there was one shadowy acquaintance whom he was fully prepared to receive at Monticello at any time. The prospect of death did not unnerve him so much as the fear of what he called a doting old age. For more than 20 years he had been telling friends that his physical health was so good that he sometimes worried about living too long. The ultimate fear was senility, what Adams referred to as dying at the top. Almost as worrisome was a gradual physical degeneration that would deprive him of any semblance of autonomy and personal sovereignty. One reason the daily ride on Old Eagle was so important to him was that it symbolized the survival of his independent spirit. Finally, there was the uniquely Jeffersonian sense that one should not linger beyond the allotted time of one's generation, that one had almost a moral obligation to clear the ground for the next generation by placing oneself underneath it. "Mine is the next turn," he wrote to his old love Maria Causeway in 1820, "and I shall meet it with goodwill, and after one's friends are all gone before them, and our faculties leaving us too, one by one, why wish to linger in mere vegetation, as a solitary trunk in a desolate field, from which all its former companions have disappeared?" This feeling of having outlived his time intensified with age. In the year before his death, he claimed that looking back over his life was like looking over a field of battle. All dead, and ourselves left alone midst a new generation, whom we know not, and who know not us. Another memorable scene made the point with almost visual clarity. In 1824, Lafayette paid a final visit to America and, naturally, scheduled a rendezvous with the sage of Monticello. An escort of 120 mounted men and a crowd of 200 onlookers accompanied Lafayette up the mountain to witness the reunion of the former comrades. Madison described the general as in fine health and spirits, but so much increased in bulk and changed in aspect that I should not have known him. Lafayette had spent several years in a Swiss dungeon, confined by the radicals for siding with the moderate faction in the French Revolution, then ballooned upon his release. Meanwhile, Lafayette described Jefferson as feeble and much aged, though in full possession of all the vigor of his mind and heart. As the two aging patriarchs tottered toward each other and embraced before the crowd, witnesses claimed they saw two ghosts from a bygone era materializing one final time for the benefit of the present generation. Given the urge to make Jefferson into a historical icon, it seemed almost awkward to realize that he was still alive. Or there was the highly symbolic but scary scene the following year, in 1825, when Jefferson consented to sit for a life mask that would allow posterity to possess a reliable likeness of the American hero, an iconographic rendering of the living icon based on a special technique designed to subordinate artistic interpretation to the actual shape and contours of his face. The American sculptor John Henry Brower poured successive coats of a mysterious plaster-like substance over Jefferson's head, but the liquid dried and hardened more rapidly than anticipated, causing Jefferson considerable discomfort and forcing Brower, as Jefferson put it, to use freely the mallet and chisel to break it into pieces, with a series of heavy blows that would have been sensible almost to a loggerhead. The experience convinced Jefferson to bid adieu forever to busts and even portraits. In addition to illustrating the dominant perception of Jefferson as a living relic of America's glorious past, the Brower incident inadvertently signaled the subsequent problems that would afflict anyone intent upon establishing a close fit between Jefferson's image and the man he really was. Even Brower's plaster cast was based on the resembled fragments of the fractured life mask. Like the man himself, even his face seemed to resist realistic renderings. But the faithful recovery of revealing moments, riding Old Eagle, greeting Lafayette, enduring the preservative techniques of Brower, provides us with only glimpses of the real person who was Jefferson in his most patriarchal phase. Such scenes also telescope and therefore distort in their well-intentioned way Jefferson's own final stage of evolution during a 10-year period when, despite the nagging intrusions of visitors and the equally nagging afflictions of age, he enjoyed the opportunity to meditate more freely and fully about his legacy than any other time in his life. One last scene, though only another momentary glimpse, offers what is probably the best angle from which to catch the main drift of Jefferson's mentality through his final decade by providing a thematic clue to the abiding concerns that were on his mind and in his heart. It was the last morning of his life, which, as if orchestrated by Providence, happened to be July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary to the day of the publication of the Declaration of Independence. He had fallen into coma the preceding evening, and awoken to ask the physician and family gathered around his bedside, "Is it the 4th?" It was obvious to all, including himself, that this was his final illness, and for several days visitors and family had been paying their respects, noting the persistence of his independent spirit. He insisted on sleeping at night with only the trusted Burwell in the room, and on flicking away the flies during the day himself. The prayer of the family that he would make it to the 4th was answered, though he was unconscious for most of the final hours. He stirred briefly, mumbling something that the doctor and family could not understand, until Burwell, the only one to comprehend what his master was asking, stepped forward to adjust the pillows. His last request, in effect, was answered by a slave, just as his first memory, at least as legend has it, was of being carried on a pillow as a young child by a slave. His last sounds were semi-conscious ramblings, apparently based on his dreams. He was back in the 1770s, giving instructions about the committees of safety and the need to stand firm against British tyranny. He went to his maker shortly after noon on July 4th, reliving the tumultuous early years of the American Revolution. This was both poignant and symptomatic. For the meaning of the American Revolution, his personal role in it and his abiding sense of what it meant for posterity, was also his central obsession throughout the final decade of his retirement. Words and music. Although an obsession, by definition, does not need any urging, in Jefferson's case, a good deal of looking back occurred at the urging, one might even say at the frantic insistence, of John Adams. The resumption of correspondence between the two patriarchs seems, in retrospect, almost inevitable. "You and I ought not to die," as Adams so eloquently put it, "before we have explained ourselves to each other." But for many years, what now appears inevitable and almost elegiac looked utterly impossible. Jefferson's narrow victory in the presidential election of 1800 had sent Adams into retirement at Quincy, where he spent nearly 12 years groveling and grimacing and twitching away in barely suppressed resentment, then firing away in his best Adams style, sending a salvo of words toward all his political enemies, Jefferson among them. "Mr. Jefferson has reason to reflect upon himself," Adams observed grudgingly upon Jefferson's retirement from the presidency. "How he will get rid of his remorse in his retirement, I know not. He must know that he leaves the government infinitely worse than he found it, and that from his own error or ignorance. I wish his telescopes and mathematical instruments, however, may secure his felicity." Adams had a way of exposing his deep-seated anger toward Jefferson in the same breath that he tried to deny its existence. "I have no resentments against him," he explained to Benjamin Rush, "though he has honored and salaried almost every villain he could find who had been an enemy to me." This last reference was to the Republican propaganda campaign against Adams during his presidency, chiefly the libelous accusations of James Callender in The Prospect Before Us, which Jefferson had in fact subsidized and approved. It described Adams as a vain, true, dangerously unbalanced, exaggerated distortion of the truth, and covertly monarchical, mostly untrue, instrument of Federalist corruption. Completely untrue. Jefferson had made a concerted effort to reopen the lines of communication with the sage of Quincy in 1804, trying the indirect route through Abigail. But he made the double mistake of mentioning his own anger at Adams for the appointment of the midnight judges and then claiming complete ignorance of the whole Callender business. Abigail responded like a lioness protecting her pride. Jefferson had once been a trusted friend, she explained, and some residue of affection still resides in the bosom even after esteem has taken its flight. But she no longer respected or trusted a man so capable of either hypocrisy or self-deception, and she acknowledged a personal sense of poetic justice when the serpent you cherished and warmed, i.e. Callender, bit the hand that nourished him, a reference to the Sally Hemings accusations. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend," she observed caustically, then declared any subsequent correspondence unnecessary. Adams himself did not see any of these letters until a few months later, when Abigail showed them to him, and he jotted in the margins, "I have no remarks to make upon it at this time and place." No more words were exchanged between Quincy and Monticello for another 8 years. If Adams spent much of that time licking his political wounds, Jefferson was having a whole new series of political wounds inflicted on him. Adams's harsh appraisal of Jefferson's latter years as president was only a more intense version of the generally negative verdict. Everything that had flowed together so serenely during his first term seemed to collapse in disastrous heaps of misfortune in his second. The root cause of the later failures, it turns out, was located in the same place as the earlier successes, namely, the European conflict between England and France. The temporary peace between these two perpetual combatants had permitted American commerce to flourish between 1800 and 1803. This, in turn, had allowed Jefferson, with Gallatin's able assistance, to perform the political magic of retiring the debt while also cutting taxes. Even as the Anglo-French War had resumed in 1803, Jefferson and his administration were the immediate beneficiaries when Napoleon decided to cut his losses in North America by selling the Louisiana Territory for a mere pittance. But the resumption of full-scale war on the continent in 1803, then the imposition of naval blockades in the Atlantic and Caribbean, threw the American economic engine into reverse. And since Jefferson's dedication to fiscal austerity had required the dry docking of destruction of America's infant navy, there was really very little strategic room in which Jefferson could maneuver as American commercial vessels were scooped up by English or French frigates on the high seas. Jefferson's answer to these multiple challenges was the Embargo Act of 1807, which essentially closed American ports to all foreign trade. The idea for the embargo originated with Madison, who had convinced himself that closing down American exports and domestic markets would eventually force England and France to alter their policies. This was always an illusion, but it blended nicely with Jefferson's more moralistic vision, which was simply to sever all connections with the corrupt, belligerent nations of Europe. The result was an unadulterated calamity that virtually wrecked the American economy, had no discernible effect on either the policies or economies of England or France, and required the federal government to exercise coercive powers to enforce the embargo, thereby contradicting the Jeffersonian principle of limited government. To make matters worse, just as the international crisis was intensifying, Jefferson had to deal with a domestic crisis with equivalently catastrophic potential when Aaron Burr, his former vice president, was caught conspiring to launch a fabulously ambitious scheme. Even today, Burr's bizarre goals are murky, to detach a substantial chunk of the American Southwest and set up an independent nation-state with himself as the benevolent despot. Burr's capture and eventual trial produced only more trouble for Jefferson, who was so eager to see Burr convicted of treason that he was willing to violate basic constitutional principles to get his way, but once again found that way blocked by that high priest of Federalist defiance, the irrepressible John Marshall, who found Burr not guilty. All in all, then, Jefferson's second term had proved just as disastrous as his first term had been glorious. He announced his decision to observe Washington's precedent and retire after 2 terms in December 1807, just as the Embargo Act was approved by the Congress. From that time forward, for more than a year, he surrendered all essential decisions to Madison and Gallatin, thereby creating a sense of drift in American policy at the very moment that the unpopular and cumbersome embargo required executive leadership. There was loose talk, even in Republican circles, of Pontius Pilate washing his hands of unpleasant responsibilities. Among the Federalists, there were gleefully mischievous comparisons to his infamous flight from British soldiers during his final days as governor in Revolutionary Virginia. He was clearly played out as president. Never did a prisoner released from his chains, he observed the day before Madison's inauguration, feel such relief as I shall on shaking off the shackles of power. It was a rather awkward and somewhat hollow end to more than 40 years of almost uninterrupted public service. As he himself had predicted in his first inaugural address, no man was likely to leave the office of president with the same high reputation that he had when he entered it. With all the advantages of hindsight, it is now easy to see that the failures of his second term had root causes in the Napoleonic Wars that were beyond his, or for that matter, anyone's control. His earlier presidential luck had simply run out. Nevertheless, the sober character of the end cast a pall over the entire presidency. It helps explain why he did not choose to list this phase of his public career on his tombstone. Up in Quincy, Adams, writing to Benjamin Rush the day after Jefferson's term ended, claimed to know all about disappointing conclusions. But at least his own end as president, Adams noted, had the clear and crisp character of an electoral defeat. Anyone attempting to deliver a benediction of Jefferson's presidency would be hard-pressed to know what to say. Jefferson expired and Madison came to life last night at 12 o'clock, Adams joked to Rush. Will you be so good to take a nap and dream for my instruction and edification a character of Jefferson and his administration? The safe thing to say, of course, was that only posterity could judge. Both Adams and Jefferson had their sights set on posterity's judgment, so perhaps the first thing to keep in mind when we consider the eloquent correspondence of their twilight years is that they were self-consciously writing to us as well as to each other. Adams had been under persistent prodding from Rush to break the silence between Quincy and Monticello for several years, Rush claiming that he kept having dreams of the two patriarchs recovering the affinity of their early years when they constituted, in Rush's memorable phrase, the North and South Poles of the American Revolution. Initially, Adams told Rush that such dreams struck him as nightmares. Jefferson was a mysterious shadow man, whose character was like the great rivers, whose bottoms we cannot see and make no noise. But gradually, the ice melted at Quincy. He harbored no resentment or animosity against the gentleman, and would certainly respond, if I should receive a letter from him, meaning that Jefferson would have to write first. Then Adams became downright playful about the matter, declaring that he would rename his Quincy estate Montezilo, a miniature version of Jefferson's grand home, wondering out loud to Rush what had caused the separation with Jefferson in the first place, and concluding that the only flit between Jefferson and me concerned hairstyles. He preferred it straight, and Jefferson preferred it curled. Or was it the other way around? Adams was clearly edging his way toward a rapprochement. Eventually, on January 1, 1812, he made the decisive move with a short and cordial note, protesting all the while that there was nothing momentous or historic about the reconciliation. Jefferson was always a boy to me, he joked. I am bold to say that I was his preceptor on politics and taught him everything that has been good and solid in his whole political conduct. How could one hold a grudge against one's own disciple? The differences between them, Adams implied, were the product of exaggerated distortions put out by their mutual enemies, especially Hamilton. The friendship could be recovered easily because it had never really been lost. It was only as if one sailor had met a brother sailor after 25 years' absence, Adams quipped, and had accosted him. How fare you, Jack? All these playful half-truths and benign rationalizations helped Adams avoid facing the fact that he was extending his hand over what had become a huge personal and political chasm. Over the course of the next 14 years, they exchanged 158 letters and created what many historians have come to regard as the greatest correspondence between prominent statesmen in all of American history. What comes through to most modern readers of the letters is the elegiac tone and the seductive serenity of two American versions of the philosopher king meditating out loud to each other about all the timeless topics, sometimes dueling for the prize in eloquence like two precocious schoolboys. "My temperament is sanguine," Jefferson writes in 1816. "I steer my bark with hope in the head, leaving fear astern." Adams responds in kind, "I admire your navigation, and should like to sail with you, either in your bark or in my own, alongside of yours. Hope with her gay ensigns displayed at the prow, fear with her hobgoblins behind the stern." Then there is their mutual posturing in the Ciceroian mode. "But whither is senile garrulity leading me?" Jefferson asks rhetorically. "Into politics, of which I have taken final leave. I have given up newspapers in exchange for Tacitus and Thucydides, for Newton and Euclid, and I find myself much happier." Adams answers with a display of his own literary firepower. "I have read Thucydides and Tacitus so often and at such distant periods of my life that, elegant, profound, and enchanting is their style, I am weary of them." He jokes that, "My senectual loquacity has more than retaliated your senile garrulity," and then finishes with a flourish that is almost Jeffersonian in its alliterative style. "Whatever a peevish patriarch might say, I have never seen the day in which I could say I had no pleasure, or that I have had more pain than pleasure." They wrote each other with similar gusto and self-conscious flair about a host of safe subjects: the aging process, the beauties and the corruptions of Christianity, the bizarre and sometimes loony characters who inflicted themselves on busy presidents, Adams claiming that whenever self-styled prophets requested an interview during his presidency, he required that they perform miracles beforehand, thereby avoiding all such wasteful encounters. The book's worth rereading, the impressive development of an indigenous American language. Jefferson was particularly outspoken about the need to allow new words like belittle and neologism into usage. "Dictionaries are but the depositories of words already legitimated by usage," he observed, "and everyday conversation is the workshop in which new ones are elaborated." Adams agreed wholeheartedly, arguing that they should join forces again to oppose British tyranny, this time repudiating England's despotic control over words. "We are no more bound by Johnson's dictionary," Adams observed, "than by the canon law of England." Adams acknowledged that words were Jefferson's special province. It was one of the reasons, he liked to tell friends, that he had asked the young Jefferson to draft the Declaration of Independence. "We shall all be asterisked very soon," Adams noted in 1821, adding, "Sic transit gloriola, is there such a Latin word, mundi." Jefferson concurred about the dwindling size of the survivors from 1776, then confirmed that Cicero himself had used the word gloriola, which meant little bit of glory, an appropriately modest description of what he and Adams and their revolutionary compatriots were due. Adams countered with the prediction that Jefferson, "as you are the youngest and the most energetic in mind and body," would be the final survivor. Like the last person in the household to retire at night, it was therefore Jefferson's responsibility to close up the fireplace and rake the ashes over the coals. The emotional climax of the correspondence as a classical dialogue between reunited patriarchs came in 1823. During the early years of his retirement, Adams had written several letters in which he had condemned Jefferson for his duplicity and criticized his policies as president. When several of these letters were published in the newspapers in 1823 without his permission, Adams was embarrassed and worried that they would undermine the newly recovered friendship, but Jefferson rose to the occasion with great style. "Be assured, my dear sir," he wrote, "that I am incapable of receiving the slightest impression from the effort now made to plant thorns on the pillow of age, worth, and wisdom, and to sow tares between friends who have been such for nearly half a century. Beseeching you then not to suffer your mind to be disquieted by this wicked attempt to poison its peace, and praying you to throw it by." Adams was overjoyed, insisting that Jefferson's letter be read aloud to his family at the breakfast table. "It was the best letter that ever was written, just such a letter as I expected."